Hi, I'm Mary.
And I'm Christy.
And we're angel investors in Budapest, working together on FinTech Factory, an early-stage fintech investment fund backed by MKB Bank.
Each month, we get together to talk about investments and innovation in the financial sector and beyond with experts from around the world.
Joyce Zhang Gray is the co-founder and CEO of Alaris, a global expansion marketplace backed by General Catalyst and other Silicon Valley VCs. Alaris enables tech companies based all over the world to enter the U.S. market quickly and effectively with a remote American country manager and team. Prior to founding Alaris, she's had an impressive career with stints at Microsoft and Groupon, the World Bank, and the Fed. She was also the first employee and VP of sales for Human Interest, one of the top 100 most valuable Y Combinator companies of all time. Joyce and I know each other from college, and we reconnected recently to talk about how Alaris can help Hungarian companies enter the U.S. market. And I enjoyed our chat so much that I invited her to be on our show. So Joyce, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your story in your own words? So how did things go after we graduated? And, you know, how did you get to where you are today?
Well, gosh, a walk down memory lane. Speaking of, you know, fintech and the financial markets. So we graduated Harvard right around the time of the global financial crisis. And that was very eye-opening and very tumultuous time, of course, around the world. Definitely a good learning opportunity for those who were lucky enough to secure a job. So I was very lucky because my first job out of college was working for the Reserve Bank of New York, which the Federal Reserve is actually the U.S. central bank. And there are a lot of reasons we call it a reserve bank, not the least of which is the U.S. just wants to be unique and different, but
like we do.
Our central banking system, as Americans do, exactly. But our central bank is distributed into 12 district banks and the Board of Governors in D.C. And I was in the New York Fed, which is the one that is responsible for setting the interest rates and basically regulating the large banks like J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Lehman Brothers, which at the time were undergoing a lot of changes. And as a matter of fact, by the end of that period, Lehman Brothers no longer existed.
Yep.
After more than 100 years history. So that's a bit of a walk down memory lane because, you know, I think seeing the macro trends in the global financial markets was really inspiring straight out of school. And it was something that really taught me the importance of the interconnectivity of our world, how the actions in the U.S. will have repercussions to Iceland, Hungary, many other countries, and vice versa. We're all interconnected and we want to be responsible and good stewards of our own finances, both on a micro and macro level. So after the Fed, I actually was thinking about grad school, but ended up getting recruited by an American tech company to go to Asia for global expansion. And this is the second piece of my journey, which is the first is the financial services, fintech appreciation. The second is global expansion appreciation. At the time, most people told me, if you're switching jobs, you can choose one of three things to change. You can choose geography, industry, or function. And I ended up changing all of them, which Mary, I know similarly, you were able to make that big leap of faith as well. Mm-hmm. And it was such an amazing experience. I would highly recommend just operating at the edge of discomfort or in the zone of discomfort, because that's where you learn a lot. I'd never managed a team before. I'd never worked abroad before. I'd never worked in another language before. I'd never worked in tech before or done sales. So all those things were really interesting. And one of the things that I really saw is global expansion is tough. Even a very, very highly capitalized American company entering a new market is going to stumble and face a lot of pitfalls that locals would have known how to solve easily. And so if you try to do it yourself, it is really tough. You really do want to rely upon those who've gone before you, those who are local, those you can trust. Having trusted partnerships is really, really important. And then finally, after that, I did go to grad school. I went to public policy school and got my MBA. And I
from
worked
Princeton
in
Stanford, by the way. So
right. I did a few stints in between as well. But, you know, what's most relevant, I think, for this podcast is two other experiences, which was my time working in East Africa for the World Bank's International Finance Corporation. And we were helping the East Africa community, which is the trade union between Uganda, Kenya, Burundi, Rwanda, and Tanzania, established their common market protocols, which is the freedom of movement of capital, goods, and services across borders, which is quite important because, again, different countries have different jurisdictions, and the way that they think about movements of capital services is really important. And then finally, my time with Human Interest, which is a fintech startup. At the time, I was the first employee, and we had this idea of trying to democratize access to retirement savings because in the U.S., unfortunately, the government doesn't necessarily guarantee that you'll have enough money when you retire. I know in Europe, that sounds like an outrageous concept, but in the U.S., you put money into what's called a 401k or sometimes an IRA, and a 401k is...
Or both now financial, in most cases.
Or both, because inflation is real and you have to save for the future and people are living longer, which is great, but that means you really need to save up more. So a 401k is a type of a tax sheltered savings account that only an employer can provide, but that the benefits are for the worker. And so it's something that technology, along with an understanding of investing in financial services, made really important. So sorry that this is getting very long. I'll try to wrap up the story, but I'm trying to point out to... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I just wanted to say, before we talk more about Human Interest, because we want to hear more about it, you've worked all over the world. You went to Singapore, China, Nairobi, New York, and you worked for big corporates. So my question is, how did you decide where you want to go and where you want to work? And then the other one is, why did you decide to get into entrepreneurship after working for all these corporates?
Well, thank you, Chrissy. That's a very great question. As I implied earlier when I talked about leaning into discomfort, I think I've often optimized for learning because careers are long. And as a matter of fact, a lot of studies show that the current generation, kids that are being born, by the time they enter the workforce, the vast majority of the jobs they'll take don't even exist today. I think over 80% are projected to be totally new and transformative. And what that really means is that in one's career, learning and the ability to accelerate that adaptability is really important. So fintech was not a concept, for instance, when I was in college. Finance was and technology was, but this combination of fintech, not so much yet because it wasn't mainstream enough. But fast forward, now it's one of the hottest industries out there. And I just went where I thought things were really interesting. I really wanted to learn about one of the draws, for example, for Nairobi is M-Pesa in Kenya was so transformative. And learning more about international finance from the World Bank IFC seemed like a good opportunity to really build out my skill sets and learn more. So I think it was mostly just with an eye towards learning. And same with entrepreneurship. This is a big challenge, something that has had a lot of ups and downs, probably one of the biggest challenges of my career. And I think I've grown and learned the most in this endeavor.
Yeah, I think this is also interesting. And I know you, so I can get into the dirty details, the backstory. But Alaris was not your first company that you founded. So maybe you can tell us, because I think this is also super valuable for people to know that, you know, you have to be open to pivot. And I think every experience forms you. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about kind of why you decided you wanted to found something yourself. Or maybe this ties into the Human Interest story, actually, because that's also an interesting one. You know, how did you even find that company and decide to join and be the first employee? I guess that was your first experience with the startup, right?
So actually in college, I was part of a startup, but I didn't really think of it as a startup at the time. It was called a social enterprise because when I was in college, social enterprises were much more in vogue. I think building on the success of, you know, Grameen Bank and microfinance and a lot of double bottom line or sort of impact investing trends. But it was a startup and it was really interesting. It was basically an ed tech company that now I call ed tech. At the time, again, that phrase didn't really exist,
right.
That helped connect people overseas with mentors in the US. And it failed, as many startups do, but I wasn't the founder. So I just thought it was really an interesting experience. I didn't really know what a startup failing meant, but it was just interesting to observe and be part of, but not really to fully understand. So fast forward with Human Interest, I was really interested in, again, this theme of something that had a social mission, something that helped people, but also fintech, because I was so interested in the field and I had some relevant experiences working at the Fed and the IFC. So I was looking online, I was talking to mentors, I was scraping through online databases where you can filter by industry and by stage of company. I thought, like, you know, I really want to have impact from day one. So I want to look at smaller companies. So I would set the filters to be smaller. And so, you know, there was a lot of searching and then a lot of back channeling, but it can feel like a long and grueling process. What the breakthrough was actually, and what got me thinking about this, is that a different company that was in a similar space was at Stanford at the startup recruiting career fair. And this is something that I do appreciate about Stanford. And I think a lot of tech hubs and startup ecosystems do this well, which is usually, you know, startups don't have the budget to recruit as aggressively as, say, like a Google. They can't take you out to dinner. They can't fly all over the world or have their team based all over the world come and talk to you directly. But I did appreciate that there are certain hubs, and I think in Hungary, you have to look no further than to talk to Christy and Mary, but there are some hubs and people who put these great events together. So at one of them, I met someone who opened my eyes to this thought of, like, well, what about retirement savings? Like, that is a huge problem that no one's talking about, or people are talking about it, but just like government policy people, not technologists. And it's such a big opportunity, ripe for, you know, disruption, as they say. So then I started looking into that space, and one of my friends from college actually introduced me or reintroduced me to the founder and CEO of what was then called Captain 401. And he was someone I knew peripherally in college, but we reconnected and I just really resonated with the vision and decided to join. And so that was how I got involved in that startup. And with my own startup, a lot of the experiences of being first employee, you're really in the trenches. In many ways, you are doing all the same things as the founders. You're struggling to figure out, you know, what price point will the market bear? How can you pitch effectively? What's the angle? What's your go-to-market strategy? You know, how do you set up systems for onboarding and customer support? What do you do if they complain? What do you do if they really like you? You know, there are all these small questions, big and large, especially on the growth and customer acquisition and onboarding side that I was responsible for. And it was very thrilling. It gave me a lot more confidence to strike out and do my own thing. And actually, that's what I did. So in some ways, Alaris was actually the first startup I founded on my own, in the sense of getting a logo, incorporating, getting a website. But I was sort of turning my wheels a little bit, figured out how to do it on a small scale kind of freelance way, but not in a scalable technology way. Part of it was because I was doing it alone. And it's really hard to do something alone, especially without a like highly technical background, and have it be a tech product. So I kind of set it aside when one of my best friends invited me to join him on an endeavor he was working on, which was called Verdic, a social polling app that used machine learning to help surface interesting topics. And it was really great. I mean, it was a lot of fun, but after a couple of months, we realized Verdic was just not getting the traction we needed. And then I counterpitched him on Alaris, and he loved the idea because both of us are so passionate about connecting people around the world and about globalization and international business and technology. And he had the technical know-how that I didn't have that could actually start turning Alaris into more of a scalable product. So that's how that evolved.
So did you know you wanted to found your own company someday, or was it kind of more happy circumstances? Kind of it fell into your lap because you were already working on Verdic. So you kind of had a great founding team that you felt like you could build something with. And then you had this idea and it kind of combined a lot of your passions and areas of expertise.
I was intrigued by entrepreneurship. I remember even in college when I joined that social enterprise, I liked the fact that it was early stage and that there were a lot of things you could do. But I didn't necessarily think of myself as an entrepreneur until perhaps even business school. And I realize now in retrospect that an entrepreneur is just someone who has the mindset to create something, you know, basically from scratch, and to really have the ambition to scale it. But it's as straightforward as that. It's really a mindset. There's no special skill or insight or network that you need. Obviously, it helps to have those things, but it really is just about the vision and the determination. And that was also a shift in mindset, because at first when I, like I said, when I started Alaris, I did want it to be a big scalable startup. But, you know, working by myself, I started to think smaller again and lost a little bit of motivation and lost steam. And I fell into freelancing, which is, it's great. I mean, freelancing and doing consulting work is wonderful for those who want to do that, but it wasn't originally my intention. I think it was because I started to lose faith in myself. And then teaming up with a friend, and even though what we worked on together was not successful initially, then we pivoted and worked on Alaris, but in this case, just felt much more confident about scaling it and growing bigger and faster. But it was, in many ways, Alaris was the same concept. In many ways, I still use some of the same words and the pitches that I had initially, but just had more confidence and conviction when I talked about it. I talked about reverse outsourcing, how in the past, globalization 1.0 was Americans and developed economies expanding into the emerging markets, into Eastern Europe, Asia, Middle East, Latin America, and Africa. And now the trend has come full circle that globalization 2.0 is all those countries expanding globally and localizing in the US market and hiring Americans instead of the other way around. Like, this is actually a talk track that I believed in before, but it wasn't until I felt like I could see the scalability of it that I started to say it with a lot more confidence.
Yes, and now Alaris is backed by General Catalyst and other Silicon Valley VCs. So can you talk about the experience of the fundraising experience? Did they reach out to you, or how many VCs did you speak with? How did the whole process go?
So VCs, in general, in my experience at least, don't often reach out until you're already really successful. So if anyone tells early stage founders, oh, like all these VCs are reaching out to me, then you know, that's probably not a fair comparison. It's likely that they were already a serial entrepreneur who had multiple exits, and that's why the VCs already had them on their shortlist. But as a first-time founder, you really do have to reach out and kind of work your network and work whatever advantage you have to reach out to them. So
just a quick one here is, actually, did your Y Combinator experience help you getting in touch with these VCs?
It did. And I would say that accelerators really help. I know that Y Combinator has a fantastic reputation all around the world. And so I encourage Hungarian startups to apply for it, but also know that if you don't get in, it's not the end all be all, because there are many ways and many channels. You just maybe have to work a bit harder to establish that credibility. But it comes back to the confidence and that mindset. If you are confident in yourself and your startup, then there's no barrier that stands in the way. So I definitely reached out cold to a bunch of VCs. I reached out through warm introductions to a bunch of VCs. I looked them up. Like, you do want to do your research because their time is limited. And I know that as a founder, it can feel so frazzling to have to fundraise, because that's a full-time job, as is running your company, which is a more than full-time job. But to make the meetings go really well, you want to run a really tight process. And by a tight process, I think CEOs are very good at this, because most CEOs are salespeople effectively. They are selling their company and pitching their company constantly to clients. So use that same energy and use that same discipline to pitch investors, because they want to be caught up in your vision. They want to know why it is that, you know, this company is going to become huge and legendary and amazing. And you want to make sure to get all of your leads, in this case, investors, sort of in your pipeline around the same time, and to systematically go through and talk to them. You don't want to do it in a sort of spray and pray approach or without a lot of discipline, because then it both drags out the process and it can make it seem to external viewers that, you know, you're not getting anyone to invest in you because your company's not exciting enough. And then that sends a bad signal to the market. So you want to run possible a concentrated fundraising process and go through warm introductions if possible. If not, really, really read up and do a lot of research on the VC. You know, tweet at them. Their direct messages are usually open. You know, engage with them on topics and in a way that you know are really interesting to them. And you just have to hustle. And then once you actually get the offers, then that's amazing. And then you have the whole negotiation process, which hopefully everyone gets to. But initially, you just want to really, really hustle and try to reach out to as many as you can in as short of a time frame as possible.
And so coming back to, I guess, your journey fundraising for Alaris, walk us through that. I mean, how was General Catalyst one of your top choices, or why did you end up going with them?
Yes, they were definitely one of our top choices. They're one of the, you know, top VCs in the world. They have a great reputation. But also, in addition to that, it's important to look at the partner that you'll be working with. So the partner we work with is actually of Greek origin and really believes in our vision of this globalized world in which borders cease to be a barrier to unlocking your potential. Because, you know, talent is universal and opportunities are not. And I think he's invested in a lot of companies in this globalization, future of workspace. But I also want to call out some of our other investors. Hustle Fund is an amazing pre-seed investor. They do investments all around the world. And the partners, Elizabeth, Eric, and Shian, are really wonderful operators. They've all been founders or worked at startups before. Shian, actually, speaking of fintech, used to be the head of business development and one of the first employees of NerdWallet, which is one of the top fintech companies in the world as well. And so they really understand very deeply, both from an investor and an operator standpoint. We also had Cardinia Ventures based in Australia. Ed is also a serial entrepreneur, founder, and investor. So I thought it was important to not just see who the lead investor would be, but also to see who else we could get to provide additional perspectives to, you know, be sounding boards for us, because it's not just about capital. At the end of the day, even though it feels hard when you're fundraising, just keep in mind that investors are lucky to have allocation on your cap table, and they're lucky to be able to be part of your successful journey. You're doing them a favor just as much as they're doing you a favor. And you want to really pick investors, not just because they're giving you money, but ideally because they're giving you value, either through their networks, through their advice, or just through, you know, their moral support. Whatever it is that you want to choose the investors that would fit your needs.
So, but going back to Alarius, can you tell us more about who are your typical customers? Do you have any Hungarians yet? And just a little bit more about Alarius in general.
We would love to work with Hungarian startups. I've been really excited about this opportunity for a while since Mary talked to me about it. So please, any startup based anywhere in Hungary, reach out on LinkedIn or on email. My email is joyce@alarius.com, A-L-A-R-I-S-S.com, or LinkedIn, just Joyce Zangray, Zhang Gray.
We'll put it in the show
that's
notes.
That's a pitch. Oh, great. That's a pitch for Hungarian startups. We have startups, actually, our pipeline of clients is around 79 countries all around the world. Our largest concentration is right now in Asia, as well as in Mexico and Canada. But we are seeing increasing interest from Eastern Europe and Latin America. And we have some as well from Nigeria and South Africa. So we are so excited to see this, because really, when I talk about democratizing access to global resources and breaking down barriers, even though it is tough because, you know, passports and visas are still a true consideration, but when it comes to the freedom of movement of services and knowledge exchange, that doesn't know borders anymore. There are no borders to the fact that I can appear on a Hungarian podcast sitting on a couch in San Francisco, and I can talk to someone in Hungary from, you know, anywhere I want in the world, so long as I have an internet connection of some sorts. Like, we could even do WhatsApp if the internet is spotty. That, to me, really shows that globalization is starting to reach some of its potential. And it feels great to me to be able to help companies based anywhere and to say, you know, your country of origin or your headquarters are not going to be a barrier to your global ambitions. And I see companies like Skype, you know, which started in the Baltics. And I look at companies like Atlassian or Canva that started in APAC. And then all these other global companies that are now household names, or even Spotify, et cetera. These companies had a global vision and they were able to exceed their borders, but they were seen as exceptions. Whereas I think in the future, that'll be the rule.
So how does it work? I mean, is there a company that's too small, or when should a company reach out? Like, what's the sort of, I know it runs the gamut, but maybe you can talk about kind of, when do companies come to you? What are they looking for? What can you help with?
So companies come to us when they want to build up effectively their branch office in the US or their go-to-market team in the US. So both of those are similar, but slightly different concepts. The first would be if they already have customers in the US. So a virtual branch office can just be, you know, sales, marketing, customer support to serve their local clients. And for instance, when I was at Microsoft, the Singapore office was the hub of Asia Pacific, and it was mostly the customer-facing roles, whereas a lot of the research and development was still in Redmond in Washington, as well as in the some big research R&D centers in China and other geographies. So there's that model, which some companies reach out to us about. And then another is recognizing that Americans are really salesy and they're good at it. And it might seem unintuitive because, again, in the past, people thought of Americans as the one outsourcing to other countries. But now there's so much movement of, again, movement of services, movement of knowledge. There are so many Americans that would be really eager to work with a Hungarian startup that's working on something really cool and very globally minded. But they just don't have access to those companies. They don't know how to. They don't have a network yet in Hungary. And on the other side of the ocean, there are a lot of Hungarian companies that probably would love to hire an American and don't realize how they could actually afford it. So we try to make sure both sides can come together. I would say it's typically good if the company has product market fit in Hungary already before they think about going overseas. It's not a hard and fast rule, but you don't want to go and expand and spend a lot of efforts in a new market if you don't have at least some understanding of where your product or service would fit. Some exceptions are things like Musical.ly, which was then acquired by TikTok, actually had much more traction and much better product market fit in the US than it did in China, where it originated. But that's, again, an exception rather than the rule. You want to make sure that you have something people actually want. That's a Y Combinator quote, build something people want. And the way that you ensure that they want it is to make sure that, you know, that you're actually getting paid for it, at least in some market, or having adoption in some market. And then the other rule of thumb, I would say, is a typical American salesperson who is experienced and has some good networks will look for roughly, you know, let's say $5,000 a month if they're working with you full time. And that's kind of a minimum. So that's usually their base salary if they're working with a global company and they're representing you. So you would want to have at least, you know, a couple of months of their payroll, or a year or more ideally, ready. But if you set expectations up front that this is an exploratory exercise for you and you just want to work with them initially and see how it goes, some of them are very open to it. A lot of Americans are now open to gig economy work or part-time work where they can have the flexibility to spend time with family and also do some part-time work representing a company. But you typically want people to be full-time, to be really dedicated to your growth. So that's about it.
Yeah, I love the concept.
You need that minimum budget.
So how does the matchmaking work? Once we have like a Hungarian company, for example, want to expand to the US as well. And obviously there are the talents in the US who have the time and energy and the knowledge that they could help. So how do they find each other on the platform?
So both sides just fill out the form and then our NLP algorithm will match them. And within seconds, we usually make the match, although we typically curate a little bit as well, just to make sure that both sides are still available, especially the talent side. And then we'll present them and the employer can decide, you know, who they want to interview and who they want to talk to. And once both sides come to an agreement, then they can just have all of payroll, everything run through us. So you don't have to set up a legal entity. This is another reason it's so much faster. Not only are the matches pretty instantaneous, but instead of having to physically fly to the US, which requires a visa, requires a plane ticket, requires, you know,
COVID test.
Going through COVID, COVID tests and quarantine. Yeah. And your visa might be denied if you don't have, you know, important work as perceived by the embassy. So, you know, there's no guarantee you can even make it to the US physically right now. But if you go to the US and then you can set up your bank account, set up the legal entity, hire lawyers, accountants, it usually would take companies about 6 months to do all of that, plus all the recruiting and customer focus grouping that they would want to do to even begin to have some traction in the US market. And that's expensive and very time consuming. With Alaris, they can immediately get someone working with them in the US from day one. And that person can be full-time or part-time, and they can start already reaching out to customers in their networks to at least get some feedback so that you can start your go-to-market process so much faster and so much more efficiently. And if it works out well, great. Scale up through Alaris, or, you know, come to the US and set up your team and set up your own office and grow that office, either way. But this is a really great entry point. And as a former, you know, operator in global expansion myself, I wish that something like this had existed when I was entering new markets. And so that's why I built this.
Amazing. Actually, our time is almost up. I just wanted to ask if there's anything else you want to share with our audience.
No, I think the only thing I really wanted to share, first, I just wanted to thank both of you for inviting me. This has been such a pleasure. And the only thing I wanted to share is that being an entrepreneur in many ways is just about believing in yourself and having that ambition. And scaling globally is also about having that vision and ambition. You have everything it takes to be successful. And so you just need to take that leap of faith.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much, Joyce. This was great.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thank you both so much.
Thanks for listening.
Tune in next month for another episode of Beyond FinTech, where we discuss the latest trends in investing and innovation in the financial sector and beyond.